Matt Segundo here. Now, you may not realize this, but there was a moment in my life in which I contemplated being a military doctor. But when I was a teenager, I scraped myself one day with a dull razor, and I fainted when I saw blood trickling down the side of my cheek in the bathroom mirror. Pa Segundo proceeded to whip me with his belt that morning, and in this way, I think I started to become a man. But while my own life is probably far less of a struggle than that of a triple amputee, I'm still finding new ways to fight for my life every day, which is probably one of the reasons I continue to practice my small hobby of heavy drinking on a nightly basis. But apparently, this daily struggle isn't good enough for Terry Sanders. No, he needs military soldiers, rehabilitation centers, and a rock to make an important documentary for our times. And he should know, because he's won a few Oscars. But if you ask me, he's missing out on a very important subject for his documentaries, namely me. I'm fighting for my life, Mr. Sanders, so why don't you come to my Motel 6 room with your camera?
Okay, so I am here with Terry Sanders, who is the director of, most recently, Fighting for Life. Terry, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Ed.
First off, I wanted to ask you about one of the things that really struck me about Fighting for Life. Namely, the way that you maintain this relatively apolitical tone throughout the film. And I'm wondering if you offered any particular criteria or instructions to the crew to keep this not political or something that pretty much everybody can see. Was this something you worked out in the editing process? Were there possibly images that you recorded that you may have struck you, perhaps, as too didactic for your audience?
The conception of the film was always, it had to be apolitical. It could not be arguing the war. It had to be the experience of those in the war. And so from the very, very outset, and in fact, we never would have gotten the access that we did if it were, a polemic of some kind. And in fact, I don't believe in a polemic anyway, because, preaching to the choir, I find, is just a total waste of resources and a total waste of time. I mean, I want to make films that anybody can see. Right, left, center, whatever. And it was always the kiss of death if anyone thought that we were on this side or that side or any side.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you, again, gave any instructions to the crew, or did the sort of non-political nature of this come about through editing, through selecting images? I'm wondering if certain images, if you were to have put them into this film, it would have been advocating pro or con against the war or whatnot.
Well, one good thing about documentaries, you tend to work with people over the years. And my cameraman I've worked with for decades, so we sort of know what we're doing. I mean, Eric Darstad is, I've probably made 30 films with him, and we're all about capturing the reality without imposing our point of view, whatever it might be. We never want to impose. We want the reality to flow into the camera, so to speak, and then the editing room be reconstituted. Now, obviously, in the editing room, one can make all sorts of choices, and one does. But again, the choices were, we don't want to get into arguments about the Iraq War. But then spontaneously, occasionally one of the military doctors says, it's not about politics. It's about these young men and women, and they're our family.
I mean, this, for example, the decision to have the audio of the Hippocratic Oath in the opening images with the hallway laden with all these photos. I mean, something like that does strike a certain semiotics of sorts. And I'm wondering if apolitical semiotics was more of your modus operandi for this.
That word semiotics is I'm not Errol Morris. I think I know what you mean, but everything in the film, was reality presenting itself to me and offering itself, and my saying this would be good and that would be good. And the genesis of this film, to begin with, was to do a film on this university in Bethesda that trains the military doctors and nurses, because the Congress and the Defense Department kept trying to close it, and the film might save it and put it on the map so people would know about it. And I was struck by the fact that the freshmen on their first day at this university recite the Hippocratic Oath, and of course at graduation they do. And most medical schools do not do that. So it has a very, very high ethical level, this school, that was just apparent. There's nothing that I had to try to attain. It was just there. And you always, of course, want to have structure. And so by bookending with the Hippocratic Oath, it sort of gave it a container, among other structural devices. And you rightly point to that wall of photographs of graduates, which became a structural element also. That's something I just discovered in the course of filming at the school. I probably walked by the wall several times before I looked at it and said, hey, this is like Alice's looking glass. I mean, you can go through it from this academic world into the real world and come back again. And what a great device.
The interesting thing talking about the Hippocratic Oath is that there's a very historical trajectory throughout this. You have, of course, the Civil War reenactment at Antietam. You also have allusions to previous medical officers in the Navy and the like. So there's this juxtaposition that this is kind of an inevitability of history to have these doctors and these medics in the battlefield. And I'm wondering, did this kind of dictate where you decided to plunge into certain milieus, certain areas of this topic, that just so you can kind of demonstrate to the audience that, well, this has been going on for quite a while. Why are you looking the other way?
Yeah, well, I think the film tried to capture the essence of what it is to be a military doctor. And a lot of documentaries try to capture the essence of something, but context is important, and military doctors didn't just appear this year or last year or this decade, but the history of it, the context, going back to Napoleon. On our website, we have a quote from Napoleon's surgeon about how to be a good military surgeon, you must scorn fortune and devote oneself entirely to one's patients. So there's a whole tradition of military medicine. So if you're going to capture the essence of it, you want to have a little flavor of that history.
You mentioned Daryl Morris earlier, and this is interesting to me because there's one moment where you have Crystal's father staring directly into the camera, and I kept thinking to myself, oh, is he doing that Errol Morris situation in which Morris projects his image of his face right where the camera is? And it's only in that particular instance, and I wanted to ask you about that.
I would not. I mean, it's interesting what Errol Morris uses, and he certainly uses it well. It seems to me a contraption that would take time to set up and maybe produce some self-consciousness, maybe, in the person. I try to minimize the equipment as much as possible, and in fact, Crystal's father was not looking directly into the lens, because I actually instruct people, look at me, don't look at the lens, because looking into a piece of glass is immediately breaks the connection with the human connection.
I guess you must have been sitting really close, because
I always sit very, very close. Over the years, my technique is I want it to seem like they're looking into the camera.
Yeah.
But in fact, they're probably looking at my right eye, which is right next to the lens of the camera.
How close do you sit to the camera? I'm curious. Are you like within inches? Or?
Within half inch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I don't feel comfortable when people are, you see some films where they're looking 45 degrees away from the camera, and immediately you think, well, who are they talking to? I want the feeling of talking to the viewer, the audience.
I wanted to ask you about one of the most striking juxtapositions of the veterans, and that is, first of all, you have Crystal Davis, who is determined to live despite the fact that she sustained this serious injury, and then you have the Iraqi army captain who is basically saying, please kill me, I don't want to live my life, to the people who are trying to help him. And you have the various medical people saying, no, you can still do good things. This was very interesting to me on several levels, not just from a juxtaposition of giving up or living on, but also from this American versus Iraqi kind of scenario. And I'm wondering why you chose the Iraqi captain to say this or to portray this. Did you encounter American vets who were along these lines, who were basically willing to essentially throw in the cards like this? Or did Crystal's story just strike you? Did you need to have some moment of hope to counterbalance a lot of the bloodshed and the difficulties of adjusting after the war?
I think that as a filmmaker, I didn't really need anything except to capture what reality was flowing in front of my camera. It is like an odyssey. I mean, an odyssey, going back to Odysseus, he doesn't know where he's going. I mean, he goes from island to island, as I recall, from high school. Yeah. And he's not, he's going home from the war. And he's not, he doesn't have any goal other than to get home. And in making this film, I'm not sure I had any other goal than to capture what was there. And so the Iraqi captain, I had no idea what, I mean, just to be there at the moment when he's told he'll never walk again was like an incredible moment. And the fact that he said, please kill me, to this wonderful young sergeant who was comforting him, it's just what happened, you know. He could have said something totally different, and Crystal could have said the opposite, whatever, you know. But I do think that there's enormous, that kind of support that the sergeant was giving the Iraqi captain, I believe, and I certainly hope that young American wounded get that kind of emotional support, hopefully from their families whenever possible, because it's very, very important to the healing that the families be involved. But there are some young Americans who don't have families, and they have a tougher time, I think.
I wanted to go back also to this idea of editing, and that was, you have, of course, Crystal Tigger is someone who she is very proud of. She can bounce back just like him, and you, of course, have a stuffed animal in her apartment that you display. Likewise, there's the boy who also has these stuffed animals that are offered to him. And I'm wondering how you go about finding recurrent symbols like this. Is this largely by serendipity, or is this kind of a matter of trying to find common visual motifs that offer sort of a rhythm to the audience so that you can, again, have this subjective interpretation going out from a relatively objective construction?
Well, it turns out that all these connections are all around us. Whether we become aware of them or not is another thing. But I'm a believer that we live among riches as far as making, as filmmakers. There's all kinds of stuff around us that we just need to become aware of and connect. And I think the mind, as human beings, we have a need to connect. And these things just pop out at you. It's not a conscious, can I find a symbol here? At all. It's almost the opposite. It's just being open and almost blank, and this just pops at you, and you say, my God, that connects with that, and this connects with that, and it feels right.
I'm wondering to what degree you discover these things later, like, for example, this stuffed animal versus Tigger scenario. I mean, was this, when you placed one before or after the other, were you aware of the other one, or was this largely kind of a more intuitive, subconscious, instinctive editing and assembling this film together?
Well, I think the Tigger was a tattoo on her arm. She talked about Tigger. Her email has Tigger in it. has her presents on her birthdays or Tigger thing. So it's just she's has a love affair with Tigger. But in the editing, how you deliver that information is something that you try different ways. I mean, the editing process, this film went from 150 hours of material down to 89 minutes, the present state. And it's tight. It's no loose material. It's you don't want to lose the audience by any moment. But it probably went through at least five or six iterations where I thought it was finished and then realized it wasn't. So a lot of it is the order of things and the weight of things, how much of this or how little of this. And that applied to like the blood and gore aspect, you know. I was very aware that obviously I shot things that were even more, much more bloody than were depicted in the film, but you have to show enough blood to know that war is horrible. And yet not too much that no one will come see the film, or they'll leave the film, or they'll just totally watch the film with their hands in front of their eyes.
You know? Yeah.
So it's a balance in the editing room.
There's one other balance I wanted to talk to you about, and that was how you depict the USU medical students at the beginning. One can look upon these lives, and it's very similar to commonplace medical students. There really is not much of a military component aside from the fact that they are dressed in military outfits and the like. But then we start to kind of see with, for example, the training course and the like, that there is this sort of component. Was this intended as a kind of entry point, as a sort of way to have the audience leave their judgments behind, for them to identify with the fact that, well, these are people, too, who are going through the same training that other medical students are, and yet there's also this additional component that puts them in a far more perilous scenario?
Well, I think by introducing the first-year students, which we do in the anatomy lab, there's a lot of empathy for them, you know, being confronted with cadavers for the first time and, you know, trying to learn an incredible amount of stuff that a medical student has to learn. So I think it humanizes them. I mean, it makes them not symbols of the military or even symbols of medical school students, but people like us, like anybody, going into a learning situation. And of course, we see them develop later as they grow in their experience and all this into these military doctors.
I was also curious about the impact of getting fatally wounded in battle. You have various nurses in Germany describing the day-to-day things that they have to hear, the questions of like, well, will I be able to produce a child with my husband, and things like that. But what I found kind of interesting was that I didn't really get a sense of the economic consequences of these veterans. We see the housing that that is provided for them. We see the physical reconstruction, the therapy, and all that. But I asked this question because, of course, healthcare, and particularly uninsured healthcare, is a huge issue. And I was curious about the overlap between these veterans and just the nature of being uninsured at large, and why this question was largely more or less unexplored. I mean, you brought up, for example, Abu Ghraib. You bring up a number of other sort of parallels to kind of remind people that this is a conflict that we're now in. But there's also this socioeconomic concern that I'm quite curious about. Were you able to uncover any particular economic consequences of these lives that these people were trying to adjust?
Very, very much so. First of all, in the film, it's without having to say it, we see the wounded getting incredibly complex and expensive care. And they talk about multiple operations. I mean, it would cost millions in a civilian hospital. And there socialized medicine, I guess, working to the nth degree. I mean, if somebody needs something, they get it. There's no applying to some healthcare insurance company or something. They get it. And then you realize that, and the prosthetics, there's high tech, you know, latest thing, all that. And obviously expensive. You don't have to put a label on it. But the aspect that what happens, you know, a year from now, 5 years from now, 10, 15 years from now. And the Lieutenant Colonel Pasquina, who's in charge of the amputee program at Walter Reed, he volunteered that these young men and women, you know, they're 19, 20, 21 years old with losing limbs and all, that we have to think about that we're going to be responsible for these people, 50, 60 years from now.
Well, it's interesting because you have the congressional issue in terms of USU getting funding and other medical academies along these lines getting funding. But I couldn't help but, of course, think, as you point out, of this notion of, well, who's paying for all these veterans? And will that funding be available if we can't pay for just the general populace to get health care? What of these folks? So I found it interesting that you kind of downplayed that particular choice in prioritization of these doctors and the like.
Well, I think there's a lot in any film that, you know, isn't directly answered but is implied. And I think there are a lot of questions that arise after seeing any film, and certainly this film, which is good, because I don't believe a film needs to... I think a film needs to address every question, but not necessarily answer it. And I think the cost issues are addressed. I don't feel like anything was hidden, but it wasn't... that wasn't what the film was particularly about either.
It is very much about these doctors who go out in the field, but then halfway through the film, it shifts towards the veterans. And so that's why I kind of bring up this question. It's almost as if you kind of split the difference between the two areas, these two topics.
Well, halfway through, it focuses on the wounded.
Yeah.
So it becomes more individual, more human. And we, with Crystal Davis, who miraculously, for the film anyway, came out of the sky in a helicopter with the lower part of her right leg blown off and her other leg in danger of imminent amputation. And we were able to follow her through the entire system, which gave a much more personal face to the wounded and the care for the wounded. So the film is almost like starts wide and narrows down ultimately to her.
There's also a systematic aspect to this film. For example, the officers pointing out to how the wounded come in, how it's dealt with, where the actual, the sort of system that one must go through, which is almost as intricate, if not more intricate, than our current sort of healthcare here domestically.
You're right. I mean, organization is terribly important, and the sequence where the school has the field exercises called Bushmaster, where they go out into the field and have night exercises and mass casualties, and you realize the importance of communication, the importance of organizing, the importance of being able to deal with the unknown events and to be prepared for all that. You realize, you know, one thing can go wrong and people won't get to where they have to go to have their lives saved. So there's a lot of emphasis on preparation.
That's true. And there's also this sense of reenactment going on, too, that had me very curious about this, because you have the, you know, the trip to Antietam, which has these historical reenactors really laying down the truth, saying, well, we had to amputate these various victims in order to decrease our mortality rate. And then you have, of course, this scenario in which they're recreating this night watch kind of scenario in which they have to go ahead and deal with mass casualties and all that. But the question I had throughout this was, okay, this simulacra, of course, is probably necessary so that you have some approximation of what it's like in the battlefield. But I never really, I mean, the lingering question, at least on my mind, was whether this is true preparation for the realities of the battlefield, which are probably tenfold, if not 20-fold, more intense and more dangerous and more...
Absolutely. Well, I think that comes out at the end of the exercise. There was a very frank self-criticism by the students themselves, what went wrong, and by the faculty. This is the one, they were not praised. They had made mistakes that would have been serious if it were a real event. But the idea is in the simulation, you make your mistakes so that you won't make the same mistakes when the reality happens. But this also emphasizes that there's no real preparation, that any mass casualty situation will take them completely by surprise. I mean, you're not going to be ready for it and it happens. It's like, you know, you're putting on your underwear or something and suddenly it happens.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's also this emphasis on the makeup artists and also the students who take a sort of glee in having these somewhat realistic wounds on their heads and these bruises, yeah, and the blood on their face. I mean, particularly there's that one subject you talk with in which she is just absolutely kind of delighted while she has all this blood on her face, and she basically declares this, oh, well, it's pretty much almost like the real thing, which is why this question kind of pops to mind. But it's interesting juxtaposition to me because it sort of suggests, well, these med students are really incredibly green. And we're going to, you know, when they actually go into the battlefield, it's not going to be fun and games like that.
Right. It's not going to be fun and games. And I think it's just, two things. One, those wounds are very realistic. The moulage expert who recreates the wounds like a Hollywood artist, makeup artist, studies actual photographs of wounds from Iraq. I mean, she duplicates them.
Yeah.
And, of course, when you then make up someone with those wounds, it's just human nature is like Halloween or makeup and, you know, making jokes. But that one young woman who says, well, you know, we're laughing, but this, you know, we heard about a soldier in Fallujah who lost his arm and was screaming and everything, and it makes you think that, you know, these wounds are not so make-believe after all. It's really very real.
I got a sort of a slightly alternative impression from that, in the sense
I take it you did.
This notion. I guess the thing that really sort of strikes me about this medical school is that, well, these folks are really green, and it's also kind of embolstered by when you talk with the library technician in the very beginning, in which she can identify who the surgeons are going to be and who the doctors are going to be by the way they actually treat people. So I guess is there a certain risk in including a moment like this and leaving it to, I guess, in my case, I obviously had a subjective reaction here.
Which was what? That they
are actually really very green, that this is a major contrast to what's going to happen in terms of the war here.
Yeah, green, but they're very serious about what they do. When you go in, we filmed, the treatment that they were giving to the so-called wounded, and they were very serious.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, which you alluded to, was the cooperation of the military. And I'm wondering, in light of the apolitical nature of this film, did you have to make any particular concessions in getting that virtually unlimited cooperation?
That's a great question. I always like to make the point that there's not a dime of government money, either Defense Department or the school's money, in the film. It's all funded independently by individuals, by foundations, by corporations, and bits and pieces. So there's no that kind of string. And also, I got like amazing access to virtually the entire spectrum of military medicine and had total creative control at the same time.
Total creative control?
Total creative control.
There were no obstacles whatsoever?
Well, there may have been obstacles, but in my written agreement, I have, it says creative control resides with me. So,
I'm wondering if there were certain aspects of this that you could not observe with your cameras.
No, I would say there is a privacy aspect, and we did not film an unconscious person who couldn't give his okay or her okay. Mm-hmm. And if they were recognizable. We filmed them if they were not recognizable, like in the intensive care unit at Landstuhl, Germany. We showed through glass what you can't quite see, but you realize you see enough to know this is serious cases. So the privacy aspect was the only one. We had to, like with Crystal, when she came in, she was conscious, and she said okay to film her, and that was that.
Did you encounter any particular resistance among certain soldiers in terms of getting their consent to film or anything? Or?
No, I did not, Ed, because I think somehow we all love to be paid attention to, even if we're in pain or whatever. I think there were a couple who didn't want to be filmed, and we respected that. I mean, I don't want to film anyone who doesn't want to be filmed, because we wouldn't wind up in the final film anyway, so... But I would say of like less than 1% didn't want to be filmed.
I'm wondering, though, if there is this respect, how you navigate this in relation to portraying sort of the universal truth. Do you feel that you kind of have a trade-off here, or is this kind of respect necessary in order to maintain a kind of a credible documentary, or a kind of documentary in which you can get people to trust you as subjects?
Well, I want people to trust me, but I also wanted them to trust me to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And that's about all I really care about. If somebody wants to stage something in front of the camera that will make some point or something, I won't film it. Or if I did film it, to humor them or whatever, it would never be in the film.
Mm. And there's one last question. I wanted to ask you about the sort of subjective nature of documentaries. You don't put yourself into this film, even though you're very close to the camera, and I'm wondering if you feel that those who do make themselves part of the documentary, that this makes the documentary more inherently subjective, that this is possibly kind of a disservice to what documentary should be about.
I have a very wide view of documentary. It goes everywhere from almost drama, using real people as actors practically, to pure cinema verite, which would be like setting up a camera and just letting it run, whatever happens. I'm very much, documentaries are all flavors. And as far as putting ones, I love Michael Moore's films, but that's not my personality, for one thing. I'm a behind the camera person anyway, and I don't particularly enjoy being out in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. And I don't have that kind of sense of humor, whatever, So I like to be invisible. And then that's what my crew, our crew is tiny, you know, three or four people, you know, when we're filming, occasionally eight if it's, we have two cameras. And we had, by the way, Buddy Squires, who's Ken Burns' cameraman, as well as Eric Darstead. But we strive to be invisible. We don't use no movie lights now at all. We don't have a microphone boom hanging over things. And particularly when you're filming people who are so involved in saving lives and limbs, they're not paying attention to you anyway. And the last thing I want would be to inject myself into it. I mean, occasionally in a film, if there's a kind of breaking the fourth wall interview kind of thing, my voice, if maybe once in a rare moment, might be there saying something like, meaning what?
Well, I'm wondering if the truth is rendered more true by being invisible like this.
Well, truth is totally subjective, just like everything else. If it's the truth, has to be the truth as I see it. You know, not if you made the film, it would be a different film. And it's just this is my film. You know.
Gotcha. Well, Terry, thanks very much. It's a pleasure chatting with you.
Pleasure chatting with you, Ed.
Thanks.